Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a twinkling crystal of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we open a choral window to a Baroque master, courtesy of the Birmingham Bach Choir. We explore tragedy through comedy by way of a conversation with stand-up comedian Lou Conran, and we get behind the magic and beauty of local singer-songwriter Danielle Cordell's craft as she prepares to release her debut album. You can catch up on all the shows to date, links to featured guests and musical interludes through our blog, www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. Now, if, like me, you're new to the very old, in musical terms at least, cast away some cobwebs and get a notepad. I met up recently with Birmingham Bach Choir's Claire Cowley to get a sense of the composer's work, the broader range of the group, and their continuing mission to breathe life into the city's choral music scene.
So I'm very pleased to be with Claire Cowley from the Birmingham Bach Choir.
That's okay.
And we're talking about Bach as in Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yes.
Not dogs and noises that dogs make, just to be clear to listeners.
Yes.
So Claire, let's start with the choir.
Mm-hmm.
We describe the choir as a chamber choir.
Yes.
So what does that mean to folks?
Well, I suppose it's smaller than some of the other larger choirs that you can have, the great choruses that play with, sing and play with orchestras, for example. Although we often have a more cut-down chamber choir and orchestra. So instead of being sort of 120 people or so in the choir, we've got about 70 or 80 people.
So it's kind of about the space it fills. Is that why it's called that?
I suppose so.
It's a scale thing, I guess.
I think that's about right, yes. So instead of being able to commit with a great row of first violins when they might have 8 or 10 first violinists in some big orchestras, we might have 4. And so it's a cut-down orchestra, cut-down orchestration, or often very much with an organ accompaniment with our marvellous organist, Martin Rawls, who plays with us.
Now, let's talk about the type of music it is. Now, I always get into trouble with folks by instantly putting labels on things.
Okay.
We had a discussion recently on the programme about jazz, and it nearly got a bit lively, which is good because jazz should be lively. But we're talking about choral music, I think. Is that it?
Yes.
Classical choral music? Is that the bracket?
It is more than pop or other forms of song, all of which are great, but that's not what our choir does. But we've seen quite a wide range within that. So although we are the Birmingham Bach Choir, and as you would expect, we sing Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, at least once a year. Some of the really great pieces that he composed, we've just done the Mass in B minor or the St. Matthew Passion, so on and so forth, big pieces like that written by him. But we've done one concert last year was of Russian religious music in Russian, which was the greatest challenge of all.
Wow. Because is that a language you speak?
No, not at all. Some of the pronunciation challenges were huge, but we sang the Russian religious music. But we also had a Shakespearean concert in the summer. It would be last year, I think, where we sang a very wide range, both what you might call traditional music, perhaps of the time of Shakespeare, right through to 20th and 21st century compositions, including by our own conductor, Paul Spicer. So, wide range of music.
So you mentioned a couple of pieces there. You mentioned the St. Matthew Passion, and you mentioned the Mass in B minor. Are those pieces of music that people would recognise, do you think? Are they readily recognisable?
I think some of those extracts from it are often quite well known, and things get used in different contexts sometimes. One of the pieces, for example, we're singing in our next concert, it involves a piece of music which is written by a man called Thomas Tallis, who was composing around the 16th century, but it's been taken and adapted by somebody called Vaughan Williams, made a most beautiful orchestral piece that was used in the film Master and Commander, which I know a lot of people listening will have heard of. And if you can picture that scene where they were having to cut away the man on the ropes who was dragging the boat behind, acting as a sea anchor, very poignant moment of the film, that's the piece of music that's playing. But we're singing it in this concert, set with a different piece of, with words, in fact, so it's for a choir instead of an orchestra, but you'll recognise the tune.
It's a very emotive piece, I think, isn't it? And you'll, I think some folks will smell sea salt and see Russell Crowe, but I think it's it's probably designed to, you know, entice other emotions, I think.
Very English, very quintessentially English music, I think, very much of its time.
So you mentioned the organ as an instrument, which is, I guess, it's not a supporting instrument. I guess it kind of sets the scene for some of the things you do. But there are things you do a cappella. I think a cappella is a big piece of the choir. So we were talking just before we started recording about different ways of using the voice as an instrument, I guess, which choirs do. So you're talking about bass and sort of baritone, falsetto, those kind of different things. Those are all Italian terms that people think, oh, I don't know what that is. But it's really using the voice as an instrument, is that?
Yes, it is. I mean, for example, the bass voice, that's the lowest male voice, is often providing a real foundation for what we all do. And so it's positioned often in a choir so that it has us all, if you like, we can all hear the bass line. And sometimes, for example, the highest voice of the lady's voice is the soprano. They can be singing something really quite ornate and dramatic and very high, and very complex pieces then for altos and tenors in between as well. I think every piece is different. The piece we're singing next, the William Byrd, sometimes there are 10 different parts going on at one time. And so without the organ playing as well, it's quite intricate to listen to, but it tends to form such a wonderful whole. For singers, it's very complicated because we've got to follow it on the music stage. But once we crack that and we sing it in a concert, I think it's really very pleasing to the ear.
It's like most musicians, I think, it's like making it look easy. You know,
that's the art of it.
It's very difficult, isn't it? But it's making it look easy.
If we looked like that when we were singing the Russian, I'd be very surprised. It was a real treat to be able to sing that kind of music. Very, very different. Sometimes it's written, for example, we've got very great conventions nowadays where you have 3 beats in the bar or you have 4 beats in the bar, and it stays like that all the way through the piece. But for William Byrd and for the Russian composers that we were singing, they tend to just fluctuate. You have 4 beats in one bar and the next has 6, then it has 8, then it has 2, then it has 4. But the great thing for the audience is they don't have to worry about any of that. The art we have in presenting that to you is so that you just listen to the line of music and you don't get hung up on that sort of detail. We might find it hard, but it's easy for the audience.
What I find fascinating about that is that very often, you know, you say to people you're recording or singing a Russian piece of music, they will instantly assume that there's a heavy, thick accent that goes with it. But accents get lost, don't they, in singing?
Yes, I mean, they're obviously very Slavic words you won't understand. I didn't understand them. We were lucky enough to have all the translations, of course. But there are some very different, very specific differences. So if you're singing someone like Handel, and you sing the Messiah, or you sing the Hallelujah chorus, you say the word Hallelujah with an H, don't you? Hallelujah. If you're singing a lot of church music written in, let's say, Christmas time, Christmas music, it'll be Hallelujah. And you'll say it with that's just sounding the A at the beginning. If you're singing it in Russian, and please don't anybody come in and critique my Russian accent here, but it's got a sort of a back of the throat sound to it. So it's Hallelujah. Hallelujah as well. It's all different number of consonants within there and sounds that are made. So it can be quite a challenge for us to get that right. But that's the upshot of it.
And there was me trying to work out the difference still between John Cale's version, Leonard Cohen's original, and Jeff Buckley. But I got lost somewhere there. But anyway, we won't worry about that.
No.
Let's talk a bit about you, Claire, because how long have you been in the choir? Is it more than a couple of years, I think?
It's actually I've just turned the second anniversary, as it were. This is my start of the third year programme.
So how did you come to the choir? Because I think you've had a bit of a musical background, or a musical upbringing, at least.
Well yes, I had very musical parents, both of whom sang, and my father played the piano as well. And I was lucky enough to have an amazing school time learning music there, singing and playing, viola, piano, singing in different groups from madrigals, it threw into sort of fairly set, like things like Handel's Messiah pieces, threw into doing things like The Pirates of Penzance by Gilbert and Sullivan, so comic opera really, operetta at school. So I was very lucky there. Then, of course, you start the world of work and things get complicated. But about 15 or so years ago, I was determined to get back to a choir. And I joined the Lichfield Cathedral Chorus then. and lucky enough still to be a member of the Cathedral Chorus, singing in the Cathedral once a week. Such a privilege to be able to do that. But then when I retired from the police, my job was in the police 3 years ago or so, I really wanted another choir, another challenge. This choir does provide an awful lot more challenge, the Bach Choir, and I auditioned for it a couple of years ago. Was lucky enough to get in, and they re-audition us every 3 years. I'm glad to say I passed that recently too. So again, get the chance to do that. And as I say, the Lichfield Choir is a much larger choir, sings sort of sometimes much bigger pieces. We get the chance to do some very much more intimate pieces of music for the in the Bach Choir.
And how do you think the choir helps sort of make the music, I was going to say accessible, but I think it's more than that, isn't it? It's about articulating that music and making it, I guess, relevant, fresh, kind of keeping it alive, I guess?
Well, there's all sorts of different strands to that, aren't there? I mean, keeping it alive, I mean, when you're talking about music that's composed hundreds of years ago, bringing it to a whole new audience, and in some cases, they like the Master and Commander music, put it in a completely different context. But I think the art of it is in the programming, none of which I can claim any credit for, of course. Our conductor, Paul Spicer, together with the team that work with him, come up with some amazing combinations of music. So you'll have quite a range, like the summer concerts particularly, you get quite a range of music all put together, but in a very artistic way. Well, the way they've done this particular next concert, where we're alternating the poetry of John Donne with the service, but then we'll get into some very different music in our next programme coming up in this early summer. I think it's in the art of programming, isn't it? And bringing something that's a fresh challenge for everybody in the audience. There'll be some things they might be familiar with, other things they may never have heard before, but always with a theme.
So you mentioned Paul Spicer, who's your conductor. Mm. He's got a hell of a job, hasn't he, I think? Because he's got to... Well, firstly, I guess he does what he enjoys, which is great. But what I was going to say is... he's got a really difficult job in terms of, I guess, working out what you don't do. You know, that's always a tricky thing. Like a curator of an exhibition, I guess. You have to work out what to focus on. And I think folks who perhaps come to see the choir will have an expectation of things that you must do. You know, you mentioned a couple of Bach pieces, but there are other things that you do that perhaps are a little bit experimental or different. So how does he work? I mean, he must be sort of he must be very collaborative, but he must be racking his brains to say, what can we do next, you know?
Well, I think, I mean, that's the art of it, isn't it? He's such a wide range of experience and contacts and understanding, and he himself composes, so I think that keeps you very fresh, doesn't it? He obviously teaches young people in the conservatoire, conducting, for example, amongst many other things, I'm quite sure. And he conducts other choirs as well. So he has such a wide range of experience. And so, for example, a new set of carols were published last year, and we sang two of them in our carol concert, the Nine Lessons and Carols, none of which we'd ever heard before. And they were fantastic carols, so obviously his skill is being able to look at a few blobs on a piece of paper, hear it in his head, and be able to get us to produce that sound that he can hear in his head. It's like you talk about the mind's eye, but it's the oral equivalent of that. He can hear what he wants. He's very exacting, he's very precise, and he expects a lot of us, quite rightly. But we have such fun doing it. It's an awful lot harder conducting than ever you would think. I got the chance to conduct a very small scratch choir just in a local village church. And I've seen conductors over the years. And I used to say, how hard can it be? But it's rather like the audience looking at the choir and not really worrying what's in the book. It's so much more difficult when it's you that everyone's looking at, and you've got to move your arms in a time, but also hear what they're singing, know what's on the page, and get what you want for the audience to listen to.
I think it's one of those things, it's a bit like directing traffic. It looks very easy, but make a mistake and, you know, very quickly you find out you've made a mistake.
Thank you.
Let's talk about some of the concerts. In June, you've got a couple of things coming up which are quite exciting. Now, I'm going to try and pronounce this, but you can help me because you're Italian, I think, is better than I. Espressivo, I think that's what he was saying.
I think
near enough.
It.
Which is sun-drenched Italian choral music. Now, that is quite an offer, isn't it, I think? And that's happening on Saturday, 16th of June, and that's at Great Malvern Priory. And if you can't get to that one, a couple of weeks later, on Saturday, 30th of June, you're at St Albans Church, which is not that far from here in Highgate, in Birmingham. So tell me about the sort of different venues and what they lend to the choir.
It's really fascinating, belonging to one choir that pretty much performs in one place to being in a choir that changes every single time. So we've sung in the Malvern Priory before, in Birmingham Cathedral. We've sung and venue in Stratford-upon-Avon. We moved up to Lichfield Cathedral. We've got these venues coming up. It's a real challenge because the acoustics can be so wildly different, and the platform on which you're standing can be very different in shape, size, and we were due to be singing up in a sort of a tiered effect on the last concert we sang and ended up having to stand on the stage with the orchestra, jostled in together, which made for a much better concert. It was absolutely the right decision, but all of those decisions made on the day. Acoustics can vary so hugely between different venues. If you've got very little cloth material in a venue and it's more sort of brick and stone and wood and what have you, the acoustics can bounce in an awfully different way. And Paul manages to bring that out from his experience. We'll say, we're going to need more here or less there, and help us to understand how the acoustics work.
If people want to find out more about Birmingham Bark Choir, they can go to www.birmingham.barkchoir.com.
Correct.
I think that's right. Okay.
And our tickets are on sale through that website with PayPal, so it's always really useful. You can catch up on the news, but also order tickets if you want.
Excellent. So we'll be coming along, I think, to the 16th of June in Great Malvern and 30th of June at Highgate, St Albans Church in Highgate in Birmingham. And Claire, for the meantime, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box. Tough subjects handled bravely and creatively now, as we catch up with comedian Lou Conran prior to her performance of I Love Lucy at MAC Birmingham. Listeners should be advised that this section explores some sensitive themes and experiences, both openly and frankly.
So here we are at the Hexagon Theatre at the MAC Birmingham, and I'm really lucky to be sitting down with Lou Conran, who I've read lots of things about you, Lou, about your show.
Oh, okay.
So I'm really sort of, I think it's a great opportunity to explore your show, which is called I Love Lucy.
Yeah, do you get it?
I see what you did there.
Yeah,
It
took quite a few people to actually get it.
I'm not sure I pronounced it in the right way. The intonation was slightly off.
I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
You have to say it really quickly. Yeah. I Love Lucy. And actually, it holds no correlation to the show whatsoever. It's just that I had the idea of the title, had the poster made, and then I thought, oh, well, it cost me quite a lot, that. So I'll just call the show I Love Lucy, and then that's easier then, isn't it?
So it was an efficiency measure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's start by talking about the show and the subject of the show, because folks coming to this, well, I suppose there's an air of intrigue, but there's also some shock from people. I've said, you know, people said, well, who are you meeting this evening? What are you doing? And I've told them, and they're like, oh, a show about that? Well, what's that about? So do you want to start by just sort of painting us a picture of...
Right, okay. Well, when did it happen? Oh, gosh, 2016, I had to terminate my pregnancy of 5 and a bit months because my baby wasn't very well. Oh, comedy. Yeah. But from that experience, I wrote an article for an online magazine called Standard Issue, which was really well received, and I had loads and loads of messages from people saying it was quite warm and quite funny and yet tragic, but it really appealed to people and really touched people. And I thought, oh gosh, well, there's something in that then, isn't there? Not because I suppose as a comedian you're always thinking there's a show in this, but at the time that wasn't my thought. But there was somebody got in touch with me who was an actress who'd read the article and said, would you mind if I performed it as a monologue at a mother's festival? And I was a bit like, well, I don't know how I feel about that, really. But the fact that she'd asked and the fact that she thought it was worth performing, I thought, oh, right, again, well, there's something in this, isn't there? And so I went to go and watch her do it. And then from that, then I wrote this show based on that article because the amount of messages I've had from people having seen her do her little monologue-y thing, and then again from the article and stuff, it was sort of, well, I have to do a show about it, really.
And there is, I think, a trajectory, if I can call it that, in comedy, where you know, great comedians and great comedy is often underpinned with tragedy and sadness and darkness in some way. So there is a tradition of that.
Yeah. There's a line that I say in the show where I say that's the thing about tragic situations. Most of the time they are hilarious because there's some of the things that people have said to me after the show. They come and share their experiences, and some of them have said, oh my God, you wouldn't believe what happened to us, or about this and this. And half of it, if you try to write that for a sitcom or for a comedy on telly, people would go, that's ridiculous. But actually, that's where the humour comes from, all these situations. So,
I was going to say it's a very brave thing. I think it is brave, but I think it's also very creative. I think creative's more perhaps an appropriate word. People always think sort of, you know, in positive ways, don't they, about creativity. But it is a creative process that you've gone through. And there is, I guess there's in some ways it's a cathartic aspect. But you're forcibly getting people to think about very tough issues. You know, you're forcing response, I guess, aren't you? In some ways.
I've never really thought about it like that before. Well, yeah, the whole point of it was because after this, the process I had to go through was called medical management. And that's when you terminate your pregnancy and you have to give birth. And then there's a discussion as to whether that the life of that child is viable or not viable. I mean, it's the politics behind it is crackers, really. But people don't talk about it. And when that happened to me, a very good friend of mine said, oh, yeah, we went through that. And I was like, I've known you for 10 years and I had no idea that you'd been through that. And she was like, yeah, but we just don't talk about it, do we? And actually, her sharing her experiences with me really helped because I told her just before I was going to go through with it. If I hadn't have had that forewarning from her and that information as to what had happened, I think it would have made it twice as hard, really. So that was my whole point, is like, we need to be talking about this because we talk about pregnancy in a really positive way and, oh, isn't it great, the baby's coming, and, oh, gosh, have you thought of a name, and blah, blah, blah. But we don't really talk about the tragic side of pregnancy and actually one in four pregnancies end in whatever way, and it's nobody talks about it. So that was my point, is to just get the discussion open, so it's not so much of a shock for people if they had to go through something like this.
I think it is often something where people, you know, that people lapse into assumption about, you know, particular norms or ways things happen, things, you know, things are done, and then when perhaps things don't go in accordance with those plans, if you like, you're right, they close down, they don't want to talk about it. They are painful, you know, very difficult, sensitive things. But I think what you've done is rather wonderful, because what you've done is...
Well, you've not seen it yet. You don't know.
but you've put it on the table. You've started people talking about it. And that's what I meant about creativity, because you're making it accessible.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to do that.
I am very fortunate to be in a position where I can do this. Stand-up comedy is that, you know, that's a vehicle where you can actually talk about anything. Absolutely anything. And if it's done right, then you can, and so I'm in a really good position that I could actually sort of get my voice heard about it, really. So I'm quite lucky in that respect.
So let's talk about you and your background in terms of comedy. You know, comedy is a thing that often people stumble upon, isn't it? They kind of find out they're funny, or they kind of let loose the humour that's been building up in them.
Yeah.
So how did you get into comedy?
Well, I've always been an idiot. So I was always, when I was little, I was always, you know, putting on little shows and stuff for my mum and dad, and I always wanted to be an actress. So I went to proper drama school and hated it, because they tried
to learn lines and things.
And they tried to drum that, they were like, no, you're too funny, no, we're gonna give you all the serious roles. So they were like giving me all the sort of serious things. I was like, oh my god, this is just awful, you'll never work. And I was one of the first people to get a job after drama school, and the first job I got was on Joe Brand's Through the Cake Hole. So it was comedy, so I thought, yeah. And then I started doing stand-up about 14-ish years ago, on and off. And that was really hard to get into, because I sort of did a comedy course when I was about 19. And I knew that I could be funny, but it was just writing the material that I had a problem with. Because that's one thing people think, oh yeah, it's dead easy to do that, but you've actually got to have something to say, and that's the bit that I struggled on. So I knew I could make people laugh, but with words it was different.
So were you doing that sort of building confidence, if you like, in writing and, you know, kind of routines? Were you doing that alongside your sort of comparing and your emceeing?
I love emceeing, because that gives me a chance to connect with people, but also I can slip little bits of material into conversation, see whether it works. So I'm sort of lucky enough in that respect to be able to constantly be able to try new material. And if it's not funny, I can just pass it off as just a conversation there. But if it does work, I'm like, oh, that's
kind of testing ground.
Yeah.
That's quite sneaky, isn't
it?
Last year, 2017, big things started happening for you, I think, didn't they? and that's no understatement, is it? But aside from everything else,
yes,
you are the BBC New Talent on the hot list.
Oh, I know, with about 3,000 other people.
That's quite exciting, though, isn't it?
I was sort of...
It's like a Michelin star.
You know? Oh, I don't know, is it? I suppose so.
I think so.
Well, I'm very... there's quite a lot of other people on that list. But
you're still on the list.
Yes, I am on the list.
You were also a finalist, I think, in the English Comedian of the Year.
Yes.
Is it, again, exciting?
Yes. Oh, my God, the final was awful. Oh, my goodness me. It was awful. at least I can say these things.
Experience.
It's all experience.
That's what it is.
And everyone sort of fights to do that competition, because the prize is going to Australia to perform at the festivals in Australia.
You've also had some fabulous roles, I think, on television. I read about these and I thought, these are fantastic roles. So I believe you worked in an abattoir in Emmerdale, is that right?
Yes, I was Eunice Hedgeson.
Wow,
was given a name, and they didn't believe that I don't dye my hair, because my hair's white, naturally white. And they said, Eunice wouldn't have your hair colour, so you're going to have to wear a wig. And I thought, I'm in an abattoir, I'll be wearing a hairnet. So I arrived and they put me in a wig and then a hairnet and then a helmet, And you couldn't see my hair anyway. So that was, and it lasted about 20 seconds. So
again, I think it's well worth, you know, embellishing that role. The other role you had is that you, I think you were a midwife in Hollyoaks.
Oh, I know, a midwife. So I was already sort of like genned up on what you do with pregnancies and things. So that was like doing a sonograph on somebody's plastic pregnant belly, which was great fun.
So these, I guess, you know, when you're sort of starting out in comedy or you're doing stand-up, you know, naturally people think that you're rushing to do television or you desperately want to be on BBC One primetime and those kind of things. Now, those things take time to do. But also, I guess what's more important is the act or the show, isn't it? You know, kind of honing that and then people discovering that rather than that, you know, being TV being the objective, I guess.
Yeah. I think you have to have... I was told by a TV person a couple of years ago, I mean, you're funny... There's nothing niche about you. Yes, you're funny, but there's you don't really have that special thing. And I thought, okay. So after that, I just thought, well, that's really quite depressing.
You touched a little bit on writing and process. And I'm always interested in when you take a show out on the road, and particularly, you know, something like this, how that show changes. Now, often that can be, you know, there are particular boundaries, I think, in comedy. Sometimes there are boundaries around particular topics, and rightly so. But I'm just wondering how they change depending on where you are, but also as the show tours, you know, as you sort of get into the third or fourth performance of the show, does it change or does...
I suppose it does, because you get more and more comfortable telling the story, and then naturally the words that you've originally written will just be then paraphrased into something else. And so, and then from that you start developing, oh, other funnier bits come in. And so it does change. Yeah. Well, we'll see, won't we?
We will see. And in terms of future plans for the show and you yourself, are you, is stand-up kind of where you are, or are you looking at... One thing I considered when I was kind of reading all about you online, you can find out amazing things about people online.
Oh dear, that's bad.
But I was thinking, naturally, I think sort of radio or podcast things lend themselves to your material. I wonder if you've got plans for that.
Yeah, they. I've sort of been approached to sort of do this show for radio, but it's kind of trying to work out how it fits on radio and just how much of the show, well, you'll see later how much I can actually get away with on the radio. And I have done a few people's podcasts talking about it, but I think radio is a real interesting medium that I would like to explore more.
Just to finish, now, the audience is a key part in a performance for a comedian. Okay.
Well, you'll be in it.
I will be in
the audience.
I'll
do the whole show to you, James.
I look forward to that immensely. I'm sensing there's a little bit of participation from the audience, potentially. Well, the door's open, at least.
Well, do you know...
But there's a bit of music as well. That's what I was going to get to. There's a bit of music that you use?
There is a little bit of music, just as an opener, and that's it. That, and then the show is just me and a story. And normally, I will involve and do audience interaction with everything I do, but this show, I'm telling a story, and I can't do that with this show. So that's difficult for me to have the discipline to not want to go off and start going on tangents and stuff. So that's been a new discipline for me with this show, is actually leave them alone and just crack on with your story. So you'll be all right. You'll be left alone.
I'll be all right. So, Lou, some of the things that you do support a particular charity, which relates to the topic and the material,
yes,
doesn't it, I think?
So last Mother's Day, I was a bit upset because it was my first Mother's Day and it was like, oh gosh, this is grim. And I'd had a few red wines, I won't lie, and I sort of discovered this charity and called sayinggoodbye.org, and they're a charity that are based all over the country, and they primarily are for people that are bereaved from the loss of a child in whatever way. And they're amazing what they do. They do loads of counselling and brilliant stuff. And within about 10 minutes of having a chat with this woman from this charity, I'd agreed to try and raise £50,000.
Wow. That's a tall order, isn't it, really?
Slightly regretting that now, but that's red wine for you, isn't it? So
so how do folks help? Where do they go?
They go to my website, www.louconran.com, and there is a link on my homepage which will take you to my donation page where people can donate money, and all of it will be very much appreciated.
Well, it's been great to talk to you.
And you.
And
thank
I think
you.
What you're doing is fantastic.
Thank you.
And I shall watch your progress with interest.
Oh, gosh.
And I shall be watching from the front row, I think.
Oh, brilliant. So we'll just sit here.
I'll sit here.
Yeah.
I'll just sit here. But Lou, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And finally, we check back on a familiar face. Singer-songwriter Danielle Cordell took time out from her hectic period of promoting and performing to talk to me about her debut album, Silence Set Me Free, and her solid portfolio of songs that have recently taken flight.
So I'm with Danielle Cordell, very excited to catch up again, because some folks might know that we first encountered Danielle through the Life of a Song project, which was a project that ran here at Mac, and you were one of many singer-songwriters who'd kind of explored a song and given life to a song, hence the title. But you've been doing lots of really interesting things since then. So so what have you been up to? Give us a bit of an update where you've...
Well, since then I've put together a body of songs and created an album. So it's taken about 18 months to get everything together and do the final recordings. And so now it's come to fruition. It lives and it exists.
It's all got serious, as they say. So were there songs that came from that project that you've worked up and kept on the album? Or
I think it was sort of around about that time that I started to work on the songs. The songs that are on the album are a collection of songs that I've worked on for years, really. When I came to the Mac and went to Dan Whitehouse's songwriting circle, that's when I started to sort of see a way of sort of working on the songs to get them into an album. And then it was sort of about a 12-month to 18-month process of working with Dan, working on the structures of the songs, getting them together, lyrical rewrites, things like that. But just getting them to a point where, you know, the true message of the songs is communicated, and it was sort of an album, a collection of songs that I felt proud of, really. And I do now. So, yeah.
And let's talk about the style of the music. So I always try and I try and explore that with people because I find it really interesting. So I would guess that we would best describe what you do as ballads. Would that be fair? Or is, I mean, it's not just that, but
no,
it's your voice and a piano. And
generally, it is. I think I was really conscious that I didn't want an entire album of just piano ballads, basically. So that's why I needed to collaborate with Dan, because he's done all the guitar, and there are three guitar tracks on the album as well. I just think it would have been incredibly boring just to have piano ballads through the whole thing. But yeah, they are ballads, I guess, love songs, folk influence. But I'm quite influenced by more recent sort of electronic music as well, like Perfume Genius, for example. You know, that's where working with Jason Tarver, who's the sound engineer and did the final recordings, working with him was great, because he could really start to create the sound that I wanted. So.
And when you were writing the songs, were there songs that sort of naturally lent themselves to the piano, or things that you wrote and parts and melodies that you worked up and you thought, well, actually, no, this isn't a piano song, this is a guitar song?
Yeah, definitely. So, for example, there's the song Heaven on the album, which just didn't work, as like the lyrics of it are so, you know, they're quite angry, they're quite sort of, and I think just, you know, on the piano it just didn't work for me. So you know, that was one of the songs that I took to Dan and said, we need to do something on guitar with this, and it's got to be kind of feisty. We were thinking about, you know, the sort of the early 90s kind of Riot Girl type guitar stuff, and it's the same on the song Shake as well. There's elements of that as well. So
let's talk a little bit about you and your background as a musician. So how did you get into music? Were you playing piano from a young age?
Yeah, I was. So my dad bought me my first piano when I was 6 years old. And I suppose you do come from a musical family. So my dad plays really great jazz and blues piano. He also write songs and things. And his mum, my nana, she had a grand piano in her lounge, and I remember my earliest memories of are of her sitting at the piano, and she had really quite an operatic voice, and she would play a lot of classical music and things like that. So
it's in the blood, really. I think so.
Yeah. So yeah, it just went from there, really. At school, I always did music, but it was my dad that taught me how to structure and write songs. I remember asking him, you know, how do you do that? And you know, he sat down and taught me.
Imparting that knowledge.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Mm. And you're Birmingham based.
Yes.
Have you always been Birmingham based? Are you kind of?
Well, I'm originally from Nottingham, but I mean, I feel like I've spent a good proportion of my life in Birmingham.
You've earned the badge.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I went to university in Birmingham, which was a long time ago now, and I've lived here, you know, I would say for about 15-16 years now, so I really feel like it's my home, you know.
And there's quite a web, isn't there, in Birmingham of, I use that word, a web of singer-songwriters and the music scene. And you mentioned Dan, you know, and Dan, I think, is one of those big figures, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know, kind of, and he's involved in all kinds of different things, but
there's
it strikes me that there are lots of other artists, up-and-coming artists, who really like to and do spark off other people. You know, there's a real kind of, you know, network, really.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what comes to mind is, I like to call her my friend, which is Hannah Brown. So she's local to Birmingham as well. And she was co-writer of the song Future Gazing, which is on the album. Mm. So that was a really great experience to work with her, and you know, I came along with the idea and a few lyrics, and then we worked on chords and at the piano at my house, and we came up with the song Future Gazing, and it's
so let's talk a little bit about the album. The album title is Silence Set Me Free, which is a great title, I think, and it says to me that there's something about stopping. Okay. When I kind of heard that title and I listened to some of the album, it's about kind of, I suppose, quite reflective as a title, you know, in terms of value. You know, perhaps one thing we don't do enough of, and this is not great for radio, but there's no, we don't value silence enough. You know, we don't give ourselves that headspace to think about where we are and what we're doing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we can just get so caught up in noise. So whether that's the environment that we're in or somebody else's noise, and we just, and being able to stand outside of that and just say enough of that.
There's that increasing pace of life, isn't there? You know, kind of everything
definitely.
Is busier and vaster and kind of.
Yeah.
I guess there's a potential disconnection that we kind of lapse into, isn't there?
I think so. Careful. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Okay. Well, and let's talk about that particular track you mentioned, Future Gazing.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a kind of crystal ball kind of song, isn't it? In
it
some
is.
Ways.
It is. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Tell us a bit about that, and we'll play a little.
Yeah. So. Basically, I came with this idea of how we can waste so much time being angry about things that have happened in the past, and then hoping for a better future and kind of gazing into our crystal balls about what might be in the future, and that actually it just ends up wasting a lot of our time and we're missing what's right in front of us. And I think that's one of the things that can be the hardest but the most rewarding, is when we can sit there and value what we have right now that's in front of us. And I think it's a hard lesson. I think it's hard to do, but that was the idea, that was the premise of the song, and I hope it comes through in it in terms of the message behind it.
The first time I put my hands together, I didn't understand what I could see. The last time my hands came together, I realized the answers came from me. I see the light in me, but still I fall so deep. Holding on to the edges, the rocks, they break away. Future gazing in crystal balls. Take a hammer to these four walls and open up my chest. Tomorrow's hope will feed me, but leaves the stay so cold and starved. tilt my head in time, allow myself a night under the stars. I see the light in me, but still I fall so deep. Holding on to the edges, the rocks, they break away. Future gazing in crystal balls. Take a hammer to these four walls. The past is gone, it's closing me. Let me breathe and let me bleed and open up my chest. Drifting with the damage I caused, lost in moments, mist shifting on a still lake, never look back. Future gazing in crystal balls. Take a hammer to these four walls. The past has got its claws in me. Let me breathe and let me bleed and open up my chest. Let me breathe again.
And that was Future Gazing, and I'm with Danielle Cordell, and we're talking about her new album, her debut album, Silence Set Me Free. Now, there's a couple of other tracks that I wanted to explore again. I think that exploring is good, I think. There's a track called Silence.
Yes.
Which is, I guess, is that the kind of title track, or is it a kind of supporting track?
It's the title track, really, and it's the same message, really, within that song. Yeah.
And the other track that stands out, I think, is a track called Hush, which is a kind of, initially, I've listened to it a few times, and it's a kind of, there's a maternal instinct, isn't there, kind of built into that that song. Tell me a little bit about that.
There's so much, I think, that's packed into that song. I mean, it's a very, very personal song. But I think, you know, to speak more generally about it, I think, you know, as a woman, one of the kind of the strands through it is this whole kind of conflict you have between becoming a mother yourself, looking at all your friends becoming mothers, but then the demands of your career, and, you know, it's all that sort of thing. But then also the other sort of thing that the other theme that kind of winds through the song is about families and about secrets that families keep, and about having to break free from that, and how actually a secret that sits in a family that is generations old and has shame attached to it can just seep through the generations. And I think when I became aware of that concept and how that can seep through families, it was a bit of a revelation in terms of my own family, but I won't go into the detail of it. But yeah, but it was a really interesting thing. And then I think it was very, very cathartic for me to sit down at the piano and express that. And actually, you know, the lyrics of, you know, I'm not going to keep quiet, actually. You hush your noise. And, yeah.
It is very rich in terms of the lyrical content. And when I listen to it, there's a couple of sort of things that hit me about it. One is it's kind of about anxiety, okay? Mm-hmm. And the other is it's kind of about bravery, you know, and the kind of, you know, standing up to things, as you said, you know, and kind of speaking out.
Yeah, I think so, and I hope that comes across in the songs. I mean, I always joke when I'm kind of performing live about how sad a lot of my songs are, but what I hope is that there's always a bit of a resolution, or there's a defiance about them, there's a strength about them where you don't sit in the position of being the victim. In the songs, it's about breaking free from it, it's about breaking through and overcoming and yeah, I hope that positivity comes through, despite the songs being really, a number of them being quite sad.
Let's talk a bit about live performance, because I think as a singer-songwriter, in some ways it can be quite a lonely pastime, I think, you know, and purposely so. You know, you have to kind of, you know, there's a concentration, there's a focus, I think, that's required. Uh-huh. You know, and you mentioned some of the sort of collaborative things that you've done with other people, and they've helped perhaps sort of translate that to other, or kind of a wider sort of band, if you like. When you're stepping out on the stage, how difficult is that in terms of the first kind of, you know, I guess it's daunting, but...
Really, really daunting. And I think I've been on quite a journey, I think, in the last couple of years, because, you know, 2 years ago, I didn't share my songs with anybody, really. And then to go from sort of sharing them within a very sort of safe environment of the songwriting circle to then performing them in front of other people, you know, that was quite a leap. But, you know, the things that I write about, it's honest and it's personal. And to share that with other people can be really... quite scary, and I can feel really quite vulnerable, and so overcoming that has been tricky, and also trying to be entertaining at the same time and not looking terrified.
There's something always, I think, about, you know, the nerves and the adrenaline. If you don't feel those things, then you've probably not quite got it. You know, you have to have those as part of the performance.
Yeah, and I think as I've had different experiences doing gigs, and I've always, you know, had the opportunity to speak to other much more experienced musicians than me, you know, especially if it's sort of a shared sort of musical arts night or something like that. And you know, they always say that, how a bit of, you're always going to feel nervous, and it's, you know, I've always taken their advice, and I feel that I've improved over time, hopefully.
Now let's talk a little bit about what I call your secret identity.
Okay.
So I meet lots of creative people, and they are superheroes in some ways. By day, your trade, you are a speech and language therapist.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And we won't dig into the details of some of that, but that, how does that inform your kind of creative side? Because I imagine that sort of, you know, they're not too far apart from each other, are
they? Yeah. In terms of subject matter and things, you know, things to write about, I mean, people that I come across, I mean, I'm dealing with people all day, every day, the struggles of working for the NHS and all that, there's certainly a lot of subject matter. In terms of technically, in terms of being a speech and language therapist, you know a lot about, you know, the anatomy and physiology of the kind of the voice and how to look after it and all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, it informs in that way. But I think for me, being a speech and language therapist is, other speech and language therapists are just such lovely and inspiring people. And it's actually one of my greatest friends of late, and you know, recently we met through speech and language therapy about 3 years ago, Kirsty Griffiths, and she's actually does backing vocals on a number of the tracks, and she performed live with me. We were out on a school visit together, and I heard her harmonising to Laura Marling, and I thought, wow, she can really harmonise. This sounds great. And so I wanted to get her involved. So
I bet you are very precise on a sound check, you folks. You know, do you know what I mean? If you know the technicalities of the voice that well.
We are.
Your roadies or your support must, you know, be banging their heads, I think. But there we are. Yeah. So, excitingly, the album launches, kind of officially launches towards the end of March, 23rd of March. And but it's kind of out there already, isn't it? So it's out there on your Bandcamp site, which is daniellecordell.bandcamp.com, which is difficult to say, but I think I managed it. And you can, folks can stream the album there, but importantly, they can buy it, download it, and you can download it in lots of lovely formats. You know, to folks like me, a FLAC format is gold. You know, you want that.
Okay,
so
right.
If you're out there and you're wondering what that is, you can Google it.
Yeah.
And wonder why I like it so much. But anyway, don't worry about that. So, what's next? You know, you kind of, are you got things that you've come across in making this album for a next album?
Or? Yeah. I mean, I think songwriting is part of me, so I don't ever stop. And I think, I've already started writing album number two. So, you know, I've got my sights set on that, but it probably won't be for another year or so yet, but we'll see.
We'll never stop with that. So, but we wish you the best of luck with the album.
Thank you.
We'll be watching your progress with interest. And thanks for your time. We'll put links and things on our website so you can find Danielle's music. And we'll play out with that track, which I think we mentioned was the kind of the title track, which is Silence. Danielle, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'm trying not to talk about the unmentionable, but the words they empty. I had no one defending me at the door. I was broken, I was needy, but I am not chained to your noise. Look up, that's me, like a bird released, and your silence has set me free.
Silence Set Me Free is out now on Reveal Records. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to the Birmingham Bark Choir, Mac Birmingham, Danielle Cordell, Dan Whitehouse, Lou Conran, Claire Cowley and 448 Creative. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 FM Switch Radio.